And since every advertisement that you hear on the air is obviously true, and since this is an advertisement that is produced by the very network that we are broadcasting on, that you call into a talk radio show and express your views and you become famous, and that when you go out into public, adoring crowds surround you and scream out your name. Since we've all come to know and love Glenn from Philadelphia, I am assuming that you are the model upon which that ad was actually predicated. Does that happen to you with great regularity?
The thought had crossed my mind, but I'm totally shocked to hear you giving voice to the idea.
There have been times in my life when I have actually been so well known that I could not go out in public without being recognized. And I want to tell you, it is a miserable experience.
Oh, fame stinks.
Oh, fame absolutely stinks. And part of the reason that I was so happy to move when my son kind of needed us to reconnect in his life after he just had a little bit of a stumble in his first couple of years of college, and then really became very well grounded and is doing marvelously now and has for quite some time. But there was a period of time where, you know, the parents needed to kind of reengage, and I was thrilled to get out of a community where I could go anywhere without being recognized into a community where I was absolutely a nobody, certifiably unknown. It was just, anonymity. To be unknown is such a pleasure. And fame is why people want to be famous. Why they like fame, I have no idea. You know, I was watched an episode of Pawn Stars the other day, and they were selling something from Frank Sinatra. To force Frank Sinatra to become famous, his publicist used to hire pretty girls who could scream really loud to be in the at wherever he was going to arrive. So if he was going to take a bus someplace or a car someplace, as he would arrange to have people with newsreels and these girls that he would literally hire to scream for his guy, you know, to be paparazzi. I once had an investor, unnamed at this point, that was worth a lot of money and is well known, but was not at the time known in terms of his persona. If you were to see him, you'd say, oh, it's a nobody. But he really coveted the fame that his partner had in this particular business. He would actually hire paparazzi. He would have his managers hire people that would take his picture and shout out his name when he would go to restaurants and things of that nature. I can't imagine.
Well, that does happen. People do scream when I arrive, but usually it's like colleagues and family members.
Yeah, I say, oh, God, no.
Exactly.
But, you know, we're making the transition here to Paul. You look at Paul. I mean, that's what he wanted to have. He wanted people only to listen to him. He wanted to be famous. He talked about his fame. He reveled in his fame, and ultimately, at the end of his life, when everyone who had listened to him rejected him, and you know, it's the last letter to Timothy. I mean, it's a sorrowful affair. Everyone has rejected me. You could see how devastated he was that he was no longer famous, and it is a motivation for a lot of people. It was a huge part of Muhammad's motivation. He wanted to be listened to in Mecca. When the Meccans mocked him and wouldn't listen to him, then he went to war against them. You know, he wanted the Jews to listen to him, to call him famous, to say that he was important. And when they laughed at him and said, oh, come on, you're a fool, you know, he terrorized them. Fame is something. you ought not covet. It gets people in a terrible fix. You look at, we're talking about the Jewish revolts over Rome. You know, Hadrian had it so bad that he wanted to rename Jerusalem after himself, and he wanted to replace the Temple of Yahweh with a temple to Hadrian. Now, that's got it bad at that point.
Mm. There's only one person capable of handling adulation or worthy of it, and that's Yahweh himself.
Yeah, yeah, and he doesn't really want to adulate. I mean, he'd like to have his children speak honestly of him so that other people would want to come to know him. But you're really, you know, I don't even think it's adulation when you're properly describing him. You know, if you say he is responsible, he is dependable, he is generous, he is merciful, he is loving, he is supportive, he is nurturing, he is dependable, reliable, truthful, empowering, enlightening, genuinely good. Are those attributes are obviously quality attributes. But I'm not sure if they're adulation. It's just
no. I think more of the picture of like a child rejoicing, you know, at a parent.
Oh yeah,
you know,
sure.
You see it, like these veterans who come home and the children are like daddy, you know,
yeah,
or you come home
right.
And your dog goes nuts. Why? Because they want to be with you.
That's, right, you know, right, right. Yeah, sure. But the only person whom that kind of praise, that kind of acknowledgement is deserved is Yahweh. And, you know, he's, I'm sure, quite satisfied if we just tell the truth. You know, don't embellish it. It's good enough. Doesn't need to be embellished. Just tell the truth, and he's fine with that. But you go to any individual and you prop them up, you know, like the popes want to be called the holiest man alive. And, you know, they just love it when thousands of people want to just have a glimpse of them. And when you're in that position, man, you are really on thin ice, because there is no person that's deserving of that. And particularly a religious person or a political person.
I often think back to the old Indiana Jones movies where Harrison Ford says, "A fortune and glory, kid, a fortune and glory." And it's like, nah, forget the glory. Anonymity and fortune, because then you can travel the world and without being harassed. You can go anywhere you want without being harassed.
You know, the one of the things that changed my view of politicians and the military, both the people in powerful positions, was getting to know them. Once I had some success in business, and I was coveted by politicians, and I got to know them, I was just amazed at by the badness, by the holes in their character. They are appalling. They are disgusting individuals. And I never found a single religious leader, political leader, or military leader. You say, you know, there's somebody I respect. There's somebody that I would gladly follow. There's somebody that has taken the time to learn the truth, speaks the truth, has all of the moral qualities and intellect that you would say, there's somebody that's special, that's deserving of our allegiance. No, they were the opposite.
You're actually more likely to find those attributes among committed entrepreneurs who, you know, self-made men, if you will, you know.
Yeah, you know, Peter Drucker's book wrote a series of books, but one of the most interesting is The Common Traits Among Entrepreneurs. And that was his conclusion, that they're the most value-driven, the most moral, the most generous, the most genuinely caring, devoted individuals. That those individuals that are successful in taking a idea and causing that idea to be manifest within a business, and then drawing people around it and promoting it and building it, that they have values that are worth following. They have character that stands out. That was his conclusion. I happen to agree. I think that while there are, while businesses for the most part is discarded today and thought poorly of, it's mainly because of the professional managers. It's because of, it's like Goodell of the NFL. He's not a builder. He wasn't around when the NFL was built. He didn't build any team, any franchise, any concept of the NFL. He is a professional manager. He's overpaid, and he seems to have no moral compass. He's not a kind. He's the kind of person that is a overpaid corporate executive. You look at it and say, "There's a reason I don't like big business." And I think if you, for the most part, the corporate executives that America gets to see are the professional managers that are part of corporations that had nothing to do with building those corporations.
It was like the advent of the NBA, as opposed,
right.
You know, the not the NBA, the Masters of Internet Business Administration, yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, for example, I got to know Fred Smith, who is the founder of Federal Express. And while Fred has his issues, as do all of us, Fred founded that company. There was a man of there that was interesting, that there was substance there, driven by interesting values. I got to know Andy Grove, the founder of Intel. The exact same kind of thing. You know, a man of who was just fascinating to be around and to get to know. And
the three generations concept: pioneers, settlers, and landed aristocracy. By the time you get to the third generation, they've forgotten what it's all about.
Correct. And it's very seldom you can find somebody that's worthy in the middle. Those that are entrepreneurs that start businesses, the Andy Groves of the world, very often, the Fred Smiths, very often very special people. We'll be back. Certainly. The fame that he sought for himself went to Paul's head, and he continued to try to impress everyone. And one of the things that I've noticed about people who are trying to impress others is that the truth is never good enough. They always need to extrapolate. They always need to take the story. You know, if you did something that would be interesting to someone. I remember during the days that I was shy, and I was trying to, back in junior high and high school, and I was pretty shy, and I was trying to, you know, get people to notice me and like me, and if I had done something that was interesting, worthy of discussion, it was difficult for me to tell the story without embellishing the story. And then once I embellished the story, then it came off like I was bragging, because I was. And worse, it then became really difficult to remember the story. So as you're telling the story and embellishing the story, then you're trying to remember what you said. So if you have to go back, or somebody asks you a question, or you tell the story again, that you can tell it the same way. And I think that's what happened to Paul. Knew that the truth was just not interesting in his case, so he had to embellish. And then he forgot what he had said, and then the more he told the story, and the more people that just didn't say, "Oh, wow, you're such a neat guy, that's such a wonderful story," the more he embellished the stories. And the further they became from the truth, and the harder they were to remember, and the more he contradicted himself. I think it's evident in his writings. Now, we were in the New Living Translation, which is neither new nor living nor a translation of Galatians 1:21 and 22. It read, "After that visit, I went north into the provinces of Syria and Cilicia. And still, the Christians in the churches in Judea didn't know me personally. And, well, here's the rub. The following words are not represented in the Greek text of Paul's letter. That visit, north, still, me, personally. There is no basis for church, and Paul did not write anything akin to Christian. In fact, you won't find anything akin to Christian or Christians in any one of Paul's letters, and yet it appears in this New Living Translation. So I was compelled, since you go to such liberty as you're going to write about that visit, north, still, me, personally, church, and Christian, without any basis in the actual Greek text, at that point you're writing a novel. And there's no pretense here this is a translation. I'm not even sure you can call that a paraphrase when you add words like Christian, that there's no hint of such a theme in the text. Nor is there any hint of the direction he traveled being north. So I read their philosophy and methodology. And if you follow a link on the New Living Translation's homepage and you click on philosophy and methodology, you'll find that they don't acknowledge the methods they have deployed in creating their supposed translation. They simply list a pair of philosophies and a method. And both philosophies are opposed to liberal transformations, the kind of things that we have been witnessing, we have experienced. In fact, every time we've cited the New Living Translation, it's been somewhere between an extremely loose paraphrase and a novelized account. So here is what they write of themselves. They say they're essentially literal, free only where absolutely necessary. I mean, it's laughable. The philosophy is reluctant to clarify the meaning of the text, though it is open to doing so when absolutely necessary for understanding. It holds English style at a higher value than the more literal approach and often adjusts syntax to help it read better, even if it makes it less literal. Now, if they were only dealing with syntax, I wouldn't have an issue. I understand that syntax is one of those things that, you know, you ought to be at liberty to change syntax. Even some grammar from one language to the other. But adding Christian, changing ecclesia to church, adding north, me, still, personally, that's not syntax. The second form that I assume this is either a philosophy or a methodology claimed by the New Living Translation is called dynamic equivalent, and then in parentheses, free, where helpful to clarify meaning. This philosophy is open to clarify the meaning of the text whenever a literal rendering of the text might be confusing to the normal, uninitiated reader. This does not mean that it deviates from the text. On the contrary, it does whatever is helpful to ensure that the text meaning comes through in English. In general, such translations try to balance the concerns of both functional equivalence and literal approaches. Wow. Dynamic equivalence. So, in this case, from the New Living Translation's perspective, if they have a feeling about how evangelical churches are interpreting Paul's letters, that they ought to be free to convey that interpretation. So the uninitiated becomes initiated. Because if they didn't add Christian, then it might be confusing. I mean, right? if they didn't change, called out to church, it might be confusing the uninitiated. And they might have never become initiated if they're not unconfused. But, of course, they're claiming that that which is confusing and that would not be understood by the uninitiated is the Word of God. So they're claiming here that for their God to be understood, they need to explain it. And that they have no compunction adding whatever needs to be added to enlighten the uninitiated.
You know, it's funny. I was going to mention the dynamic equivalence, and I had my hermeneutics classes and that sort of thing while in school. I had teachers who sat on the NIV committees and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And a classic example of this is where Paul says, "Shall we continue in sin that grace may abound?" And in the King James it says, "God forbid." But there's no God. There's no theos in there. There's right. no forbid. Right. The Greek is "may genoita," which translates literally as "may it never be so." But that is obviously very deadpan and doesn't convey the emphasis. So, in suggesting things like how do you get the emphatic nature of this across, they would say it would have been better translated as something more like, "No way," or "absolutely not," or even "hell no," is what these we were thinking around.
Yeah. What's so also interesting is that I studied those phrases in Greek, and they really aren't "hell no." They really aren't "no way," and it doesn't even "may it never be so." It's actually presented, and the grammar is such that it's presented as this is a condition that may in fact be real. In fact, it's even conveyed it's a condition that I want to be real, but I'm not willing to establish a bright line that is distinguishing between yes and no here. So it is a condition of which there is great probability, certainly possibility, if not probability, and that the writer is not taking a stand one way or the other. They're posing a question of which there is certainly the possibility and even the probability of it being so, of which the reader is not, the writer is not taking a side.
Well, but the "may" is clearly negating. Right, "may"
The "nay" is a negative term, but it's not an emphatic negative. And almost always these were written, and Greek, unlike Hebrew, has only two real conjugations: ongoing or completed action. And in Greek, many of the verbs are written in such a way that they are possibilities, probabilities, unlikely scenarios. So the likelihood of the event happening is a big part of the Greek grammar. And in this particular phrase, as it's written by Paul, the probability, the possibility is extremely high. And so it's not written in the... That was one of the things that's so surprising about this. It's actually written in such a way that it isn't. It's the antithesis of the emphatic no. You know, when Yahweh was asked by Abraham, "What about Ishmael? Could he be part of the covenant? We just solve all this right now. You'll accept
Ishmael."
And he used the most emphatic no that exists in the entire Hebrew language. I mean, absolutely not. Don't ever bring this up again. No. And the way that Paul is phrasing these, and he uses this three or four times.
And they presume to put God in there. God
right,
forbid.
Right,
there's no theos in there at all.
There is no God, and there is no absolute.
Mm-hmm.
What's also interesting is that if you look at the context of Paul's statements, the context is almost always that Paul has just come out of a rant, and he has negated, for example, the Torah, and saying, you know, the Torah is cruel, it's mean, it's enslaving, it's of the flesh, it no longer has any value, it cannot save. Does that mean that the Torah is completely useless? And then you said, then you'll have this this line. And, you know, he has just said that the Torah is negated, it has no value, it cannot save, it's mean-spirited, it's of the flesh, just completely incompetent. So that does that mean that the Torah is completely useless? Oh, may it not be. And the way that he's saying it is, it's actually, well, you know, from this perspective, maybe I wish it wasn't, but it is, you know, so don't deal with it.
What did Nietzsche have to do? Much in every way. He goes back and forth.
Right. Yeah. And so most of those statements are Paul. He has just done everything that he can to negate the Torah. Like when he has one of them when he's talking about the woman whose husband has died and that frees her of the Torah. You know, what he has said is absolute rubbish. And then he'll have a line, you know, that means that the Torah is rubbish. Oh, may it not be, you know. But it's in the context that he's used it, he's saying, you know, come on, face reality here. The problem is with God. The problem is with the Torah. And what I just don't want you to do is I don't want you to be able to say that all Paul ever says is the Torah is absolute rubbish. So I'm going to put in a line like this here and there in the midst of my argument that doesn't provide any argument. It just gives somebody the ability to say, wait a minute, Paul said no. He said, oh, no, God forbid. No, but he didn't say that.
That itself can be a persuasion technique. If you create irresoluble ambiguity, right. Sometimes you get to get people to say, okay, whatever you say, you know. Okay.
Right, whatever. Yeah, I know. Yeah, wait a minute. You just contradicted yourself. I want to go along with the program because you want to beat everybody to death and kill everybody that doesn't go along with you. You eternally condemning everybody that doesn't go along with you. So what is it you want me to believe?
just tell me what to say.
Yeah. But that is a the very discussion that you were having on dynamic equivalence, had that class done, which I think is the single most important thing to do in translating, and rather than just look at that particular phrase, which they did, but to look at it in context and to say, was this an emphatic no, or was the context him demeaning the Torah? And if he's demeaning the Torah, then it can't be an emphatic context where he is saying, well, then, you know, should the Torah has no value? Oh, may it not be. That can't be what Paul meant after, 20 sentences denouncing it.
Right. So you're not quite sure. What exactly do you want us to do with it then? read it.
Well, you know, and Paul, you really have a tremendous problem because the writing quality is so poor. He contradicts himself so often, and he contradicts God so often that what are you going to do with it? If you were to translate Paul's writings as he wrote them, even if you make the adjustments for between languages and syntax, what you're left with is something that is so deplorable, so poorly written, so internally contradictory. There is no way you can base a religion on it, and yet half of the Christian New Testament is based on Paul's letters. So if you don't pretty it up, if you don't create what they're trying to call a dynamic equivalence, if you don't read your religion into it and enhance it, You'll lose. There won't be any initiative. So you'll lose everybody.
Well, most Bible students walk around with a dialectical tension in their minds between Jacobus and Paul, right? Because, you know, show me your faith apart from your works, and I'll show you my works as evidence of my faith. That's pretty clearly in contrast to what Paul's saying, and they constantly have to tap dance around that. Right. We have Yahusha saying, you know, this is their work that they believe in him and the Father has sent, you know, some of those things. Or certain New Testament things just are very glaring. The deaths of Ananias and Sapphira, you know, they make a pledge of some land. They sell the land, but hold back on some of the money, and God strikes them dead in the presence of Peter, as it's conveyed in Acts. That's always a very, you know, what? You know, that's like, what?
If you look at the Sermon on the Mount, Matanyah 5, 6, and 7, and you set that against Paul's letters to the Galatians and to Romans. They're the opposite. They're absolute opposites. It doesn't work. I mean, and it's impossible for Paul, because if Paul is claiming to represent the very person whose testimony is emphatically contradictory to his own, there is a 0% possibility that Paul is telling the truth.
Right.
I mean, so you have the Yosha is telling the truth, or Paul is lying. I mean, those are really your only options, based upon what we've experienced thus far. Nothing the New Living Translation has published has been essentially literal. They have shown no reluctance to clarify the meaning of the text. So we must assume that they don't abide by this philosophy, and that it was stated as a diversion tactic. Or they believe that it was absolutely necessary to revise, ignore, change, or extrapolate most everything Paul wrote. Now, I recognize that this is standard operating procedure in politics, where even though the public has access to their constitution, for example, their elected officials reinvent its meaning on a daily basis. But Paul's epistles are positioned as the inerrant word of God, making this practice fraudulent, deadly. As for their pervasive use of what they called dynamic equivalence, we must conclude that they believe everything Paul had to say would have been confusing to the normal, uninitiated reader. And that means that if Galatians is to be considered scripture in the sense of being inspired by God, then the folks working for the New Living Translation believed that God was a very poor communicator. Now, I'd be remiss if I didn't point out that the concept being initiated in a religion, especially its mysteries, dates back to the Babylonians, and it is something that Paul has continued to promote. So the initiated, the initiate, is an essential part of Christianity and pagan religions for a very long time. It's a huge part of Mormonism today. It's a huge part of Freemasonry even today.
And the initiates are to be deceived.
Oh, of course. You know, if you look at one of the things I did when I was trying to understand Islam, I found the best way to understand Islam was actually to understand Freemasonry. And I spent a year and a half reading everything I could on Freemasonry. And because I wanted to understand Adam Weishaupt, the Order of the Illumes, and how that has manifested itself today. And it was essential to understand the nature of Islam. And you might say, you know, why would you need the two? Well, you know, in Islam, the Quran rails against Satan. You know, it says Satan's really bad. Satan's, you know, mean and does terrible things. And yet it's obvious when you read the Quran that Allah was modeled after Satan. I mean, Allah and Satan are the same in the Quran. And I really struggled trying, and I don't anymore, trying to understand why a book inspired by Satan would speak ill of Satan. And it wasn't, but it was Freemasonry that where I learned that because in Morals and Dogma, by the time you get to whatever the highest level is, 33rd degree,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, what they do in Freemasonry is they have deceived you all along, telling you that the God of Freemasonry is the same God of Christianity, even though when you become a 33-degree Freemason and become a Shriner, they reveal that, yeah, the Holy Book is really the Quran and it's Allah. But prior to that, they're telling you it's really God. But then at the end, at the 33rd degree in Morals and Dogma, written by Pike, what they say is that Satan does not want to be known as the adversary. He wants to be known as the illuminator, as the source of light. And so all of a sudden, I say, oh, now I get it. The reason that Satan rails against Satan, as Satan means the adversary, he doesn't want to be known as the adversary. He never wants to be worshipped in an occult religion. He wants to be worshipped as if he were God. So what he's going to do is going to rail against the adversary title and promote himself as if he were God. And, you know, that is what we see in these kinds of initiate religions, is that the person is misled all the way along into believing that what they're doing is mainstream and good and moral. And at the end, when they own them, when they've scared them to death, they reveal the truth.
Well, and there's ample opportunity to realize that they're being lied to. It's like just what they do with the letter G in the compass and the square logo. Okay.
Of course.
They begin by telling you God, then they tell you your geometry, then they tell you it means degeneration, and then they finally get around to telling you it's an Ouroboros serpent chasing its tail.
Right.
But it takes forever, and you're deceived at each level. They say, we know we told you this, but it's really that.
Yeah, we'll do a show on Freemasonry one time.